www.themouthmagazine.com.
Tony Visconti, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Thank you.
How are you, sir?
Fine. How are you, Steve?
I'm very well, thank you. The list of people you've worked with is absolutely incredible. T-Rex, Sparks, Iggy Pop, Thin Lizzy, many, many others, including, of course, David Bowie. Our time is limited today, so we're going to focus on Bowie, both as an artist in his own right and as the inspiration behind Holy Holy, the supergroup made up of collaborators, friends and admirers of the great man. I'll begin by asking you a little bit about working methods. I once read an interview with Morrissey talking about his 2006 album, Ringleader of the Tormentors. He said that he employed you, and I quote, to do a specific job, though he didn't actually say what that meant. I would imagine that for Morrissey, a specific job means one thing, but bearing in mind the legends that have arisen around Bowie's working methods, for David, perhaps a specific job would mean something else. Perhaps a lack of specifics, actually. For you, was it a case of taking on a different role each time you worked together, reflecting where he was at, perhaps?
Well, David and I approached every album the same way. We started out with a handful of ideas. He rarely wrote an entire album, and we went in and said, okay, we had all 10 tracks previously rehearsed and previously worked out. And in the beginning, when we started working like that, specifically on The Man Who Sold the World, it was very frustrating because he changed from the Space Oddity album, where he actually did write most of the songs before we recorded them, to this different kind of writer, an exploratory one. And he wanted to kind of feel out different waters, you know, places he hadn't been before. So he would often come in with a set of chord changes and just a simple idea, no lyrics, no melody. And Mick Ronson, Woody, and I would start playing along, and we'd kind of feel it, and David would jump in and say, ah, now I know what we have to do. So it was very much a collaboration when he was writing the songs on The Man Who Sold the World. But for me, that was the first time, and I was a young novice producer, and I thought, I can't work this way. I have to know what I'm doing. You know, I have to know what the songs are. For instance, we recorded most of The Man Who Sold the World on the penultimate day it was finished. And on the last day, we were still waiting for a lead vocal so I could mix the song. And he stepped up to the microphone and said, I think I have the lyrics now. And he sang the lyrics to me the very first time on the last day the record was being made. And I was pulling the hair out of my head. You know, I wasn't happy. I was relieved, but I wasn't happy.
In your autobiography, you suggest David was quite often distracted and unengaged in the studio process and had to be brought into line. It's hard to imagine someone doing that, taking him to task, I guess. But I suppose that's where your long friendship would have come into play. Oh. I suppose I'm talking about working on the later records.
Well, I didn't have to do much of that in later years because, you know, he was a much more organized person and he had already tasted success and he now knew what it took to be organized and focused. But he was terribly unfocused around The Man Who Sold the World and the Space Oddity album, the first two albums I had done with him, because he really didn't understand who he was yet. He didn't really know what his strengths were. Mm. And when we did Space Oddity, you know, we could have chosen his musical theater voice, when he was imitating Anthony Newley. We could have gone that route. The best thing we had was his 12-string guitar and his voice, and that's the thread that runs through that album. And on the second album, again, we knew that we needed to be a rock band. That's the one thing we didn't have on a Space Oddity album. But by then we had met Mick Ronson, but it wasn't, you know, very obvious what form it would take. So fortunately, we all lived together in a flat in Beckenham. And yes, David was distracted. He had just married Angie Bowie, and with the money he made from Space Oddity, he was running up and down the old Kent Road buying antiques.
Okay.
while we should have been rehearsing. And this is, you know, everyone else knew this too. I'm not making this up. And so by the time we got into the studio, we got him a little more focused on what we were doing. But, you know, he had kind of a low threshold of boredom. If we were concentrating on a difficult area, that the three of us, I mean, the rhythm section, he'd wander off and either have, you know, hang out with Angie in the lounge, or they would go off. They would just disappear and maybe look for more antiques or something like that. But that was the last time, I'm happy to say. You know, the Man of Solar World turned out so great, and by the end of it, he was on the same, we were all on the same page.
Yeah.
And so that's the real last time I had to, like, really make him walk the straight line in the studio. After that, the albums were always a joy to make, always a delight and a joy. He was there. And, you know, in recent years, David has stated that he is the co-producer, and I have to admit, he certainly was the co-producer. He had grown enormously.
We passed up on the stairs. We spoke of was and when. Although I wasn't there, he said I was his friend, which came as some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone a long, long time ago. Searched for form and land. For years and years I roamed. I gazed a gazeless stare at all the millions here. We must have died alone a long, long time ago.
In those early days, some of the naivety, if you like, if that's the right word to use, in the studio would be because making a record was quite a novelty. It was only studio production was only really 20 years old, or studio production as we know it.
True, but in 20 years, I think all the things were in place. You know, the multi-tracking, which actually began earlier with Les Paul.
Yeah,
I think our generation valued that more than Les Paul's generation. In Les Paul's generation, they thought it was a novelty for one man to play six guitars on his own record. So the Beatles certainly brought that style of recording to a very high level of sophistication. And a running joke with David and I was every time we made a new album, we'd say, let's make our Sgt. Pepper's now, you know. In other words, let's go crazy with the studio techniques is what we were trying to say. So, yeah, even though it was 20 years old, it was still, actually not much has changed today. If you listen to a Kendrick Lamar album, there's tons of overdubs and tons of freaky sounds and just little snippets of music coming in from nowhere. That's very much the way Revolver sounded too, you know.
Yeah, I always think as well about George Martin and the Beatles, that in terms of the studio, they pulled each other in opposite directions, if you like. That George was very organized and formal, and the Beatles were very experimental. So I guess they gave each other something.
Definitely. Yes, you're absolutely right. And they were a perfect match, as any relationship should be. One element should be the yin and the other should be the yang.
Yeah. Well, Bowie Visconti is almost one word in some ways, or rather amongst many other things. It definitely means quality. There were a couple of gaps, though, in Bowie's career after The Man Who Sold the World. He worked with Ken Scott on Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust. I've occasionally wondered what those two records would have been like with you at the helm. Is that something that you've ever considered?
Well, I was, in those days, by then, very capable of producing Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust, but we fell out over management, not artistic differences. There was a person that he wanted to go with, and I couldn't go that in that direction. So it's a shame. Had that manager been a different person, I would have still been on board to make those two records. But they're great records. Ken Scott did a lovely job. And of course, if I did them, they would sound different. I mean, that's all I can really say.
It was 20 years between Scary Monsters and Heathen, because you worked with David through the latter part of the 70s, ending up with Scary Monsters before he went into his pop phase. And there was this gap of 20 years before Heathen. As a collaborator, when you got back together to work on Heathen, had he changed over that time, do you think? Was he a different sort of artist?
Oh, he was mature, for want of a better word. He really, you know, had grown up and grown smarter and wiser. And the 20-year layoff between the both of us it had that effect on me, too. I had worked with many other really great artists, and I honed my technique. My techniques were much, much better, and my judgment was better. And we came together as peers, you know. And I didn't fall to pieces in those 20 years. I actually had some great successes in that time.
Yeah.
And flops, and so did he. Flops and successes, you know. So when we came together for Heathen, we were in a real good space. And that album was absolute magic for me. The way it was effortless. It was really a wonderful album to make. It was just he and myself, and we used a wonderful drummer, Matt Chamberlain.
Oh, yeah.
As our drummer. So often in the studio, it was no more than the three of us. And the rest of the musicians came by and overdubbed on those pieces. You know, we finished the album on the last day of the album by doing that song Cactus with it. The instruments were ready to be packed up, and David said, let's cut one more song. And the only musicians you hear on that track are David and myself.
Right.
So, and, you know, we did that in 3 hours, that track. So
fantastic.
It was just a wonderful coming together.
Sitting here wishing on a cement floor, just wishing that I had just something you wore. I'd put it on when I go lonely. Will you take off your dress and send it to me? I miss your kiss and then I miss your head, and the letter in your writing doesn't mean you're not dead. Just run outside in the desert heat, make your dress all wet and send it to just wishing that I had just something you wore. So bloody your hands on a cactus tree, wipe it on your dress and send it to me.
In your autobiography, you're described as someone who lives in the now, in the sense that you don't particularly look back. But in the year since Bowie's death, I would imagine you have had good cause to look back and perhaps take stock. On the anniversary of his death, you published a beautiful piece on your Facebook page talking about the day that he died, the moment the news came in. You'd been working with him on the Black Star album, and indeed that had just been released. So during that working time, you obviously will have known that he was ill.
Yep.
How difficult was it to keep that a secret, but also to keep working?
Well, everyone involved kept it a secret, and it was actually dealt with in the first day that we knew. It hardly was an issue when we were working, and we started working January 2015, and all the way to October of 2015, at least David and I were still working on it. By that time, with Tom Elmhurst as our mixer, and it wasn't an issue really. It was his private business, and in every sense, when we were together, he was full of energy and enthusiasm. He couldn't be happier. He had Lazarus in the making, and his album Black Star was virtually finished by October. You couldn't meet a happier person on the planet at that moment in time. But, you know, in view of what happened afterwards, of course, I've gone through several stages of grief several times since then. And it's only on reflection that I view it with some sadness. Although most of the time I cannot forget how enthusiastic and happy he was. That's kind of what always brings me down to earth again.
Yeah.
Cheers me up, yeah.
The record itself feels like some sort of end piece, perhaps, or some sort of monument to David's career, which makes me think that if his imminent demise was factored into the work, to the writing and to the work, it can't have been a happy record to make, but I'm fairly certain that's not true. That's not something that would have appealed to David, the doom and gloom thing.
Absolutely not. I mean, he wrote about death many times before in other decades, on other records.
Yeah.
This was not, like everyone thinks, it was not his farewell record. He wanted to make another one right away. And I'm sure there would have been a third. He was probably into making a trilogy, as far as I know. I can't read it. You know, I didn't know that. But I certainly knew that there was a follow-up to Black Star in his mind, anyway. And I knew he had written some new sketches for that album. But it's only on reflection that it seems like a farewell album. And it's contingent in the writing. If you want to look at it that way, you could interpret it that way.
Because also, like the next day, there are references to the past all over it, whether that's emotionally or texturally. I'm thinking particularly texturally, the harmonized snare drum on Love Is Lost, for instance.
Yes.
So it feels like Bowie was acknowledging his age in a way, acknowledging his legacy as well.
Yeah, I think about 50% of the next day was about the past, and the other 50% was about the future.
Yeah.
You know, whenever I look back, I don't look back with nostalgia. I look back to like a bunch of techniques that I did, and so did he. devices, you know. An author can write about new things, but use the old devices, because especially if they are the author of the devices, too. So we did. We did use the harmonized snare drum and a bunch of other things. You know, the very wide ADT on his voice, which we'd had a lot on Scary Monsters. But that's in our repertoire. That's what we do. It's like you can't invent new chords. Everyone uses the same 100 or so guitar chords, you know.
Must have been great 35 years on to still be able to fuck with the fabric of time.
Absolutely.
Well, to round up, Tony, obviously you've been hugely successful outside of your association with Bowie, but that is the working relationship which in many ways has defined your life. And in a way, I feel that Holy Holy, the band, is probably acknowledgement of that. And that's definitely the case for Woody Woodmansey also. Woody appeared on this podcast a couple of years back and said he's very happy with that, but he's much happier that the band kicks ass.
That's true. We do. It's a great band. And, you know, Woody and I are the only two original musicians who played with David in that band, but all the others are very avid Bowie fans. Glenn Gregory is a superb lead vocalist and chosen specifically because he doesn't sound like Bowie. We didn't want to, that would be an embarrassment if we had a Bowie clone up there with orange hair. Glenn's got no hair whatsoever, and he's got a very, a very big baritone voice, and he's a real great interpreter of lyrics. He's a real lyric man, you know. He knows what he's singing about. He puts the proper emotion in there at the right time. The guitarists are crazy Bowie fans. They know all Mick Ronson's riffs, all of them. And my daughter, Jessica, is in the band, and she grew up as a baby on David Bowie's lap, you know.
Amazing.
So, you know, it's really, we're really a good band. Part tribute, part original band members.
Excellent. Tony, thank you very much for your time, and good luck with the Holy Holy tour, which is through the end of March and the beginning of April. It's been a pleasure. Tony Visconti.
Thank you, Steve. Good talking to you.
www.themouthmagazine.com